Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Surprise Jeb podcast. I'm your host, Zach Ruger, surprising you with new topics every single episode and jabbing you with your daily dose of UFC. And guess what? It is our 75th episode of the podcast. Play the trumpet, shoot some confetti. How about that? The 75th episode. We're only going to have one 75th episode of all time, so might as well go out with a bang. I don't know why I said that. We're not going anywhere, but we do have a fun one. Do have a fun episode today. We're going to be recapping UFC Vegas 88 on today's episode, as well as wrapping up our 48 Laws of Power series we've been going through. I was planning to make my March Madness bracket live on the podcast, but due to time, I think we might do a surprise episode Tuesday or Wednesday, maybe throw in a couple of other surprises I've been working on. Of course, WrestleMania is under a month away. I was thinking about going through and revisiting all the past WrestleManias for my WWE fans. But yeah, that might be an episode we do in the future, as in the next few days, because I do got to get my March Madness bracket officially made. I want to make it live on here with you guys. But yeah, we're also going to be going over some new UFC news, NFL news, some movies and TV shows I've been recently watching. Got a lot of fun stuff planned for today's episode, so let's not waste any time. Let's get right into it. And first off, Let's go over one thing real quick before we go. I mean, we got the introduction done, but happy St. Patrick's Day, late St. Patrick's Day. It was lots of fun having St. Patrick's Day. A couple of my buddies came down. I was hanging out with a bunch of my other friends. It was lots of fun. Friday, we actually had a big football game. It was like 5v5, 4v4, and it got physical. I actually woke up this morning with a black eye. I don't know how it didn't show up Saturday or Sunday, but it showed up today, so I have a semi-black eye, which I found pretty funny, from eating some elbows. But my team won, so I got like two touchdowns. It was pretty fun, and honestly, like, we want to get outside more the warmer that it gets, you know, shoot some basketballs, throw around the football, hit some baseballs, just any form of activity that gets us outside. Saturday, lots of fun, started drinking early, went off to the golf range, actually. That was pretty funny. Got some McDonald's, hit up the bars, watched UFC, watched hockey, all sorts of stuff, and Sunday was a pure recovery day. But we're back at it Monday. We're getting things going. We the week's got to keep going. All right, summer's looming. I gotta find out what I'm gonna do for the summer, but I'll work it out. I'm always quick like that. But yes, let's get into our new UFC news, because guess what? The UFC news is not going to tell itself. So in the past few days, we actually have had some new UFC news, which I find very, very fascinating. And we're going to start that off with the fact that Brendan Allen has a new opponent for his April 6th fight. He was originally supposed to fight Marvin Vettori, top 10 matchup at middleweight. Instead, stepping in on short notice will be Chris Curtis. Chris Curtis coming off win over, who was that? Marc-Andre Barriot? Chris Curtis got a win over someone earlier this year. So the main event of UFC Vegas 90, April 6th, Chris Curtis, Brendan Allen. They actually have fought before. Fun fact. They fought back in, I think it was like 2021 or something. And Chris Curtis actually knocked out Brendan Allen in like round number one, which was, or round number two actually, which was a huge upset at the time. But hey, it's been 3 years. Brendan Allen's now ranked number 6 in the division, 6-fight win streak. Chris Curtis is currently ranked 14th. I'll be interested to see what goes down in that matchup. Also announced, UFC 301 in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, has had two major fight announcements. You could even say three. The big one being Alexander Pantoja, your men's flyweight champion, will be defending his belt against the number 10 ranked Steve Ercig. I kid you not, Steve Ercig, who got a killer KO last weekend, is somehow wound his way up into getting a title shot. So super happy for him. There's actually like no one else for Alexander Pantoja to fight between the top 10 guys. I mean, number 9, Tim Elliott, number 8, Alex Perez, number 5, Matthias Nicolau, number 4, Kai Kara-France, all coming off losses. Number 2, Brandon Moreno, coming off loss. Brandon Royval just lost to Alexander Pantoja, so can't do that fight. Now Cape is not able to. He's currently ranked number 6. Muhammad Mokaev didn't have that impressive of a performance. He's ranked 7. Amir Albazi, ranked 3, is actually recovering from an injury right now, so they gave it to Steve Ercig, who just knocked out Matt Schnell cold, so good stuff to Steve Ercig, but he's going to have his hands full with the flyweight champion Alexander Pantoja. Also announced for UFC 301 going down in Brazil, the return of Jose Aldo, one of the greatest featherweights, one of the greatest UFC fighters of all time. Jose Aldo is back. He's going to take on number 14th ranked Jonathan Martinez in the men's bantamweight division. Jose Aldo coming through to save this card because this card is super, super beat at the moment. I mean, just no big fights, which I find very unfortunate. I find very unfortunate they don't have that many big fights, but what are you going to do when you have all your Brazilian fighters booked a month or two before the card? You know, you got Charles Oliveira, you got Alex Pereira is also. You have a Brazilian champion, Alex Pereira, and he can't even fight Gilbert Burns. He just fought, who else? Paulo Costa. Apparently that they're still trying to find a fight for him, but he can't get one. You already booked Halton Almeida before this. I mean, just absolutely disaster booking-wise, but you know what? We'll take what we can get. Also announced for that card, fresh off a win, Michelle Pereira, who did he knock out? Michelle Pereira, Michelle Pereira submitted someone, 2 weeks ago at UFC 299, and now it is completely escaping my mind. But Michelle Pereira, who rides a 7-fight win streak. Michael Olakajasek, yes, fresh off a win over him. He'll be taking on Makhmud Muradov at UFC 301. So there's about 3 good fights on that card, but nonetheless, I'll take what I can get. All those are fun fights, and Michelle Pereira is still not getting a ranked opponent with a 7-fight win streak. That's crazy. Also announced going down at UFC 302, June 1st, in rumored New Jersey, Michelle Warson Gomez and Jillian Robertson, two legends of the fight game, two legendary women. Michelle Warson actually ranked number 14th, and Jillian Robertson ranked 15th. This is kind of a winner stays, loser should probably retire situation. They're both on pretty bad losing streaks, but you know what? Excited to see what happens with those two ladies. And also, last but not least, Julian Marquez will be taking on Zach Reese on June 8th. And an unannounced UFC fight night at the Apex. Zach Reese previously was undefeated, perfect 6-0, before he was shockingly knocked out with a head slam by Cody Brundage at UFC Austin back in December, which was just absolutely terrible because Zach Reese was so promising and Cody Brundage sucks, but what are you going to do? As for Julian Marquez, always been a guy who has just been one big fight away from breaking into the rankings, but always gets finished or something, which I find pretty funny, but you know what? A lot of fun fights coming up down the stretch. UFC 300 still looming. We have 2 more fight nights. Actually, 3 more fight nights. Wow. To get through. And if they're like the one we had this past weekend, I'm a little bit worried. Because as we're going to learn, it was not the prettiest card this past weekend. Not to sound like a Debbie Downer, but I mean, it was just Boringville. But nonetheless, fun times in the UFC world as we move on to a different league. That is right. We have had some new NFL signings. That's right. Of course, we've been talking about last week, a lot of big plays over the weekend, even more big plays going down. First off, the Minnesota Vikings doing a little trade. The number 23 and number 232nd pick from this upcoming draft were traded. That's what we got in return, I meant, from the Texans. We give them our number 42, number 188th, and our second rounder next draft. So, yes, the Vikings now have the number 11 and number 23 pick in this draft. I definitely think we're trying to cook something. Of course, we're going to be drafting our next franchise QB, which is very weird as a Vikings fan. You know, I don't think we've ever really drafted QB to be like our franchise guy. You know, it's just not something we do. We always trade for them, just develop them or something. But nonetheless, we'll see who we get. JJ McCarthy, Drake May, Jaden McDaniels. I mean, I'll honestly take any of them. I'm not going to be mad with who we draft. I know people will be mad. I can only think of some people I know who are going to be pissed that, oh, we drafted this guy, we should have drafted this guy. But for me, there's so many talented QBs. It's a toss-up between who will suck and who will do good. I'll tell you, speaking of QBs, though, the Pittsburgh Steelers traded Kenny Pickett away to the Eagles. That's right, Kenny Pickett, former Steelers starting QB and draft pick from, I believe, 2 to 3 years ago. I think 2, actually. No, I'm trying to think. From Pittsburgh, is moving to Philadelphia. That is right. He's going to be Jalen Hurts' backup. Pretty crazy scenario there. Russell Wilson was like, hey, you know what? I don't want no white boy on my team no more. I saw what I had to deal with Jeff Stidham, but now I'm just playing. Russell Wilson, of course, is now the the Steelers starting quarterback. Very odd thing to be saying there. But yes, Kenny Pickett will be the backup under Jalen Hurts. And honestly, if Jalen Hurts goes down, Kenny Pickett, pretty reliable option as the backup. Also in the QB realm, of course, the Raiders dropped Jimmy Garoppolo after his depressing season. Looks so aged, looks so withered. I know so many moms find him handsome, but not helping him on the playing field. He's agreed to terms with the Rams on a one-year deal. So how about that? Matthew Stafford and Jimmy Garoppolo on the same team. If you'd have told me that in 2016, I'd have called you crazy. But nonetheless, Jimmy Garoppolo now the backup to Matthew Stafford. Big one in the lineman deal as left tackle Tyron Smith has signed with the Jets. He got a bag. He got like $50 million. Gonna be blocking for left tackle. I thought he was offensive guard. Never mind. But anyways, he'll be helping out that Jets team with a fresh Aaron Rodgers. But I'll tell you what, the big news from this weekend, as we know for a fact that Caleb Williams is going to be a Bear, as the Pittsburgh Steelers have traded for Justin Fields. How about that? You go from Kenny Pickett to Justin Fields. I don't know if that's an upgrade. It might be, but very interesting stuff there. That is right. Justin Fields will now be donning the purple and not the purple, the gold and black. What is it? Yellow and black, whatever you want to call it. I don't know if him or Russell Wilson is going to be the starter or backup. Pretty interesting. You just got two starting QBs from different franchises, different conferences, now meeting in the Pittsburgh area. But you know what? Bears definitely need a fresh start. They need to switch things up to some regard with how they've been playing lately. So we'll see what Justin Fields brings to them, but his time in Chicago has come to an end. And honestly, I'm happy for them. I think, you know, this was his last season to prove himself. You can't keep giving the guy chances after chances after chances. I mean, he had DJ Moore as a weapon and still couldn't get it done. Bears in rebuild mode. Fun stuff for Buffalo Bills fans, as they've extended Teron Johnson to a $31 million extension. The quarterback will remain with the team. Very good help in the backfield, dealing with all those pesky wide receivers like Tyreek Hill. The Saints have actually signed Chase Young to a new deal. He was previously on the 49ers, but you know what? Saints looking to do something, as they are pretty much just a team where you look at them and you go, they don't really have any chance of winning their division or the Super Bowl. But you know what? Chase Young was super good on the Commanders. Didn't, you know, almost won a Super Bowl, but see how he does in good old New Orleans. And the final news I'm going to bring you for this episode is that my boy, one of my favorite quarterbacks, not just quarterbacks, but favorite human beings. I know he's not the most skilled, but he is a great person. Josh Dobbs has signed a one-year deal with the 49ers. That's right. If you beat him, you join him. Because we beat the 49ers on Monday Night Football. I don't think he was in that game, but you know what? Happy to see Josh Dobbs getting a team. He is just such a good locker room guy. I feel he just brings such a positive energy with him. He's also smart. He knows the game. And guess what? He did win a couple games for us. He won like two games over the NFC. He actually owns the NFC South, if I'm being honest. He beat the Falcons and the Saints back-to-back weeks. It's unfortunate how things worked out, but you know, Josh Dobbs no longer with the team. I think we should drop Jaren Hall and Nick Mullins. I mean, they both freaking suck. We got Sam Darnold as our backup, which I saw a lot of people hate on, but I mean, Sam Darnold as a backup, I mean, I think when I think of backups and I hear Nick Mullins or Jaren Hall, I kind of go, ugh. When I hear Sam Darnold, I'm like, okay, you know, that's not too bad. He was a starter for a while, but Josh Dobbs, happy to see you with the 49ers. I don't know if we're going to get any more big signings, any more big news, but that's all the NFL talk we have for today's episode. You know what? We're going to have plenty more to come as the season rolls on before the draft comes up. And honestly, I've just been itching to talk about March Madness, but of course, we'll be saving that for a future episode. There is something I did want to talk about. That's all the movies and TV shows I have been watching as of late. I've just been absorbing myself with all sorts of different shows. First off, what I got back into today was Invincible. That's right. Part 2 of Season 2 officially came back out. I just watched Episode 5, which is technically the start of the... It's so weird. It's the second part of the second season. It makes no sense whatsoever. They're apparently going to release Thursdays at 2 in the morning, which is, I wonder if they're going to have 10 episodes, 8 episodes, but nonetheless, back with a bang. Of course, you got Invincible, Mark, what's his name, Norman or whatever. I can't remember what the character's name is. That's how long it's been since I last saw everything. Absolutely fun seeing him back on the screen. Everything's picking up, leading up to a big fight, big reveals every episode. Gory, bloody, always enjoy watching Invincible. And honestly, I was a little hesitant to get back into it because I know that's been so long, but heck, I just got right back into it. Also, what I've been watching, I rewatched Barbie last night. First time I've watched it since I saw it in theaters this July with my past July with my girlfriend. And honestly, Ryan Gosling's performance just gets better with age. I mean, he is so funny as Ken. And honestly, the movie version of I'm Just Ken just cannot be beat. I understand the Oscars one was good. I understand hearing it on your phone, Apple Music, Spotify is good, but seeing in the movie, so amazing. I was kind of skimming through it a bit though, you know, I wasn't like fully immersed in it, but still good. I won't lie, the jokes probably did land a bit better in the theater, unbeknownst to me, hitting them with it. Certainly the Will Ferrell one-liners, the Ryan Gosling one-liners, but nonetheless, still an amazing movie. I might have to rewatch Oppenheimer, though. I honestly might have to rewatch Oppenheimer because I fell asleep through like the final hour of that movie. Another funny movie that I watch, which is on HBO Max or just Max, is She's Out of My League. She's Out of My League. Very funny movie. It stars the guy who voices Hiccup in How to Train Your Dragon. He's been in other shows before, but he basically somehow pulls a super attractive like model chick, whatever it is, and she's out of his league, of course, as the movie says. And it's just a typical early 2000s comedy. It also has, this guy was in Transformers 4 with Mark Wahlberg. He's the guy that died. He's been in so many different things. I wish I could think of his freaking name. Oh my goodness, it's going to kill me. But gosh, can I think of... There's got to be some details about the cast or whoever. T.J. Miller, that's his name. T.J. Miller, who I find absolutely hilarious. He's in this too, which I find very good. So I recommend that if you need just a pretty bad comedy to watch. Speaking of bad comedies, which this movie actually wasn't that bad. On Amazon Prime, Ricky Stenicki, starring John Cena, Zac Efron, and oh my gosh, the ginger guy. He's a comedian. Him and Bobby Lee have a podcast. Andrew Santino, I think his name is. Ricky Stenicki, super funny. John Cena is basically this washed up drunk. He does covers of bands, but makes dirty jokes about it. And Zac Efron, his two buddies, they made up this guy named Ricky Stenicki to always get them out of trouble whenever they would get in trouble or wherever they wanted to go away on a trip. They'd tell their wives, hey, we're going to see Ricky. And eventually the wives caught on. They're like, hey, you need to invite Ricky to this party. And these guys, by chance, run into John Cena. He's an actor of sorts. And they're like, hey, we'll pay you to act like a Ricky Stenicki. And it all works out. It's all super funny. And it just feels realistic. It feels like this could actually happen to someone with how ridiculous it is. But, I mean, I thought it was a funny time. But I am a little suspicious with how much John Cena is getting screen time. He's getting more shows. He's appearing at the Oscars nude. I don't know what's going on with him in Hollywood. But I think John Cena might be in with the elites, if you know what I'm saying. Speaking of elites, talking about the greatest trilogy of all time, I may think it's the Planet of the Apes, but I do think that The Lord of the Rings is one of the best trilogies of all time, one of the best series, if you will, of movies. And I rewatched all three movies, Fellowship of the Ring, The Two Towers, Return of the King, all the extended versions. I kind of just fell asleep to them over the last few nights, and honestly, they are so amazing. The fight scenes in the Two Towers and the Return of the King, the battle scenes just really get you going. The extended version is honestly a lot. I honestly don't even remember what the normal version was after watching the extended version. There was just so much scene, so much screen time, but super enjoyable. And after watching those, I really do not understand why they made a TV show, because the TV show actually sucks. Was it the formation of the rings, whatever. I don't even know what it's called, but I've heard it's just not accurate at all. And I also forgot how it all ended. Like, it did not end super happy. It kind of ended sad. I was very confused. I did not remember how the Return of the King ended. And I was like, dang, that's really how the story ends? You know, kind of like concludes everything, but also kind of emotional. Also kind of a teary-eyed movie. Other two movies that I watched, of course, gearing up for Kong, Godzilla, The New Empire. I rewatched Godzilla King of the Monsters and Godzilla vs. Kong, and let me just tell you, there is nothing wrong with big CGI monsters fighting. Just get you going, get you hype, and I love the lore. You know, I'm a big lore guy when it comes to things like a Game of Thrones lore. I've reading about the Dune lore, Star Wars lore, even the Lord of the Rings lore, and this whole Monsterverse lore is super cool, like this Hollow Earth. Imagine if our world had a Hollow Earth. That'd be so cool. I'd want to go down there and investigate everything. But Godzilla King of the Monsters, probably the third best movie, maybe the fourth best of the Monsterverse. Kong Skull Island's definitely the top. Then the first Godzilla, then probably the second Godzilla, then Godzilla vs. Kong might be better than it, but you know what? They're not meant to be these Oppenheimers, these Dune Part 2s, these Barbies. They're not meant to be these movies where like people look for intricate things. They're just a monster mash of fun. They're just meant to be goofy, meant to be a fun time. And honestly, I have a fun time every single time that I watch it. So very much enjoyed watching all those movies, watching all those shows. I recommend each and every one of them to all of you. If you just need something dumb to throw on in the background, that's what I've been doing pretty much. And I'm so excited to be throwing on basketball soon. But for the movie and TV realm, let me know if there's any shows that you guys think I should watch, that you guys think I should check out, because I'm always looking for new shows to look at. We're all business on today's episode as we reach our co-main event of the evening. That is right, the 48 Laws of Power. We are finally done, ladies and gentlemen. I have finished 46, 47, and now 48, and I'm ready to hit you with your final three laws. It's been so much fun going through all of them, but I won't lie, it's been exhausting. I've been bombarded with information. I'm honestly ready to read like a fiction book before I go to bed. Reading all this nonfiction stuff, and like Law 47, I think it was, I was really reading something, and I was like, that's literally the United States that we live in now. And it was kind of like dark thoughts, like, gosh, like sometimes the world can be so evil, and are we in decline? But nonetheless, we look for the good in things, so let's get us going with law number 46, which says, never appear too perfect. Here's what the judgment says. Appearing better than others is always dangerous, but most dangerous of all is to appear to have no faults or weaknesses. Envy creates silent enemies. It is smart to occasionally display defects and admit to harmless vices in order to deflect envy and appear more human and approachable. Only gods and the dead can seem perfect with impunity. I very much like this as, be honest, whenever you're doing something and someone keeps winning, someone keeps doing something, or you see someone in life where it appears that nothing goes wrong in them, you start to envy them, and envy turns to hatred, and hatred can turn to something much darker. Here's a fun quote from Soren Kierkegaard, who lived from 1813 to 1855. Wow, how fun. An admirer who feels that he cannot be happy by surrendering himself elects to become envious of that which he admires. So he speaks another language. The thing which he really admires is called a stupid, insipid, and queer sort of thing. Admiration is happy self-surrender. Envy is unhappy self-assertion. Oh, fun quote. Well, the transgression of the law, of course, there's a transgression and the observation. Transgression is the opposite of what you're supposed to do. And it basically talks about these two lovers named Joe Horton and Kenneth Hallwell. Back in the 1950s, they met at the Dramatic Arts Academy. Basically, they began to work on, especially Orton started to work on, writing plays of sorts, writing and starring in plays. Joe Orton was able to make his play, one of his most popular ones, Entertaining Mr. Sloane, into London's West End, where it received excellent reviews. But along the way, his partner Kenneth Hallwell began to become envious of him. They were living together, they were a gay couple of sorts, and they basically just became to become jealous of one another in a way. And Hallwell was trying to launch his own career as an artist and was trying to do his own thing, and he just kept falling under the shadow of Joe Orton. And eventually, in 1967, just days after Orton had put the finishing touches to his play What the Butler Saw, which is regarded as his masterpiece of plays, Kenneth Hallwell bludgeoned him to death with a hammer and then took 21 sleeping pills and died himself. Leaving a note, if you read Orton's diary, all will be explained. And in Orton's diary, he had been secretly recording, not knowing that his partner had been reading it, that he felt that his partner had been becoming jealous of him, becoming envious of him, and was worried that something may occur. And something did occur, because all this envy and hatred built up and led to his demise. You know, this is a very very drastic measure, but I mean, envy, which the philosopher Kierkegaard calls unhappy admiration, takes hold. You may not see it, but you will feel it, either damping your brilliance occasionally, purposely revealing a defect, weakness, or anxiety, or attributing your success to luck, or simply finding yourself new friends. Never underestimate the power of envy, especially from someone you love, someone you know. I mean, this guy's partner became envious of him, and Joel Orton was like, you know, he suspected that he'd become envious as he was being so successful, and Kenneth was struggling, and little did he know, it led to his death. Here's another quote from the great La Rochefoucauld, who lived from 1613 to 1680. Ooh, it takes great talent and skill to conceal one's talent and skill. That is a very fun quote. Think about how many of us are good at something, a sport, a video game, a certain practice. You know, I'm something from rock climbing to skiing to running to even just counting backwards. It takes a greater skill to hide that skill from others, to not make them feel like they're less superior than you. The observation they gave for this came from way back in the ancient days of, what was this, France, I believe this was, Florence and Medicini. There was two families, the Medicinis and the Cosmos, the Albazis. Oh my goodness, there's no way I'm going to be able to explain this, but basically, there was these multiple families in long ago Italy, of course, the early days before everything was actually made into a country, and the one family, the Albazis, they were trying to punish the Medicis for their success. And the son of the one of the great leaders of the Albazis, whose name was Cosimo, was able to solve the problem. He was able to solve this problem of this one family getting jealous of the other's success and was waiting to put them down, waiting to attack. And he was able to solve this in two ways. He secretly used his wealth to buy influence among key citizens, and he placed his own allies, all cleverly enlisted from the middle classes, to disguise their allegiance to him in top government positions. Of course, they had a government, but it didn't go under the Italian name. Also, he worked behind the scenes to gain control, but he also publicly presented a good image of himself. And after he died, after ruling for 30 years, the citizens wanted to build him a great tomb and celebrate his memory for kind of uniting these great families by not letting them be torn apart by their bitterness. And he said that he asked to be buried without any pomp or demonstration. Machiavelli, one of the great great philosophers of the time, has hailed Cosimo as the wisest of all the princes, for he knew how extraordinary things that are seen and appear every hour make men much more envied than those that are done in deed and are covered out with decency. This was a very good case of just if you're able to work behind the scenes and make sure that not everyone make sure that everyone gets their way, you know, even when you know that you are superior and better. It's just all the key to the law 46, never appear too perfect. Plutarch said this, of all the disorders of the soul, envy is the only one no one confesses to. I mean, no one wants to admit they're envious of you. I mean, no one wants to do that, but unfortunately it does become the case and it can lead to bad things. Take this from Genesis 37 of the Bible. Joseph and his coat. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a coat of many colors, and his brothers envied him. And when they saw him afar off, they conspired against to slay him. And now they said to one another, behold, this dreamer cometh. Now come therefore and let us slay him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. Even in the Bible, the most influential book of all time, has cases of all the laws in this book, especially one of envy. There have been a lot of envious men in history. It never leads well. Here's the image for you. A garden of weeds. You may not feed them, but they spread as you water the garden. You may not see how, but they take over, tall and ugly, preventing anything beautiful from flourishing. Before it is too late, do not water indiscriminately. Destroy the weeds of envy by giving them nothing to feed, or even just ripping them out from the source. But in this case, it's giving them nothing to feed. Don't give them any water, you know, make them seem, this is obviously a metaphor, but just make yourself not seem as better than them. Here's something from Baltasar Gracian. We've heard many quotes from him. Upon occasion, reveal a harmless defect in your character. For the envious accuse the most perfect of sinning by having no sins. They become an Argus, all eyes for finding fault with excellence. It is often their own consolation. Do not let envy burst with its own venom. Affect some lapse in valor or intellect so as to disarm it beforehand. You thus wave your red cape before the horns of envy in order to save your immortality. Very fascinating here. Just this law is just straight up. Just be careful of those who are envy, and don't let people get envious of you. You know, I always like to kind of dip down to other people's levels, especially when they're saying a problem. You know, you listen to their problem. You know, you don't really offer a solution, but you kind of slip in. Like, I kind of relate to you, man. I've dealt with this recently. Even if you haven't, you can make it up. It's all about not seeming too perfect, because that can lead to one's downfall. Very, very dark, very sinister at times, but you have to be aware of it. Almost done. Law 47. Do not go past the mark you aimed for. In victory, learn when to stop. Very good for war generals. Here's what the judgment says. The moment of victory is often the moment of greatest peril. In the heat of victory, arrogance and overconfidence can push you past the goal you would aim for, and by going too far, you make more enemies than you defeat. Do not allow success to go to your head. There is no substitute for strategy and careful planning. Set a goal, and when you reach it, stop. Now, obviously, this doesn't mean like, oh, once you achieve a certain level of success and you want to keep going, you know, oh, yeah, you can keep achieving stuff. You know, think about if Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk had stopped at a certain point. No, it's not what's saying. This is just saying you have to be aware of when you reach certain levels to know when to stop. It is all about situational stuff. The transgression of the law here was absolutely beautiful. It talked about the great Cyrus, who led the immense army of Persia. It was able to take over so many areas. He took over Persia, the Media, basically purged the original origins of the Persian Empire, crushed Babylon, took over that. And he set his sights on a fierce warrior race led by Queen Temeris called the Masangetae. And the Masangetae, you know, they were aware of Cyrus and his group. They were aware of his immense army that he was marching on them with. And as they approached a river, I forgot exactly what river it was. It was a very specific one, but something in the Middle East, African area, you know where all the Mediterranean, if you will. And Cyrus was able to basically trick Masangetae into, leaving some of her troops, like, exposed, and he was able to capture them. And one of them was her son. And she basically told him, like, hey, like, you know, stop conquering everything. You have my son. Give me my son back. And Cyrus's greed and hunger to just take over everything. I mean, he had taken over the Persian Empire. He had taken over Babylon. He had conquered everything. And you know what, he had her son, and she was content to try and settle a peace treaty, but her son killed himself due to his him knowing that Cyrus would not let him go, and that he was going to take over everything. And out of rage, Queen Masangetae was able to just get basically every tribe, every person in her area that she knew to come to her side, and she crushed Cyrus. And when she found his corpse on the battlefield, she cut off his head and shoved it into a wineskin full of human blood, crying out, "Though I have conquered you and live, yet you have ruined me by treacherously taking my son. See, now I fulfill my threat. You have your fill of blood." Cyrus would never have enough of the killing, of the conquering, and eventually became his doom. There's nothing more intoxicating than victory, and nothing more dangerous than that. Very, very, very drastic situations, I know, but at the same time, it's all how you apply them to your own situations, okay? The observance of the law actually came in the form of a mistress, that of Madame de Pompadour, who was actually born just a simpleton woman, middle woman, and this was back in the 1700s when all the King Louis of France, they used to have mistresses. They had their wives and their mistresses, and the mistresses were always younger to the king, always would fill their roles, of course, of entertaining him, but she was able to become the longest standing one of all time because she was able to, you know, always know when to stop. She always knew when to stop. Aware of the temporis of her power, you know, everything was temporary, the queen's mistress would often go into a kind of frenzy after capturing the king. She would try to accumulate as much money as possible to protect her after her inevitable fall. But Madame de Paris succeeded where all others had failed because she never pressed her good fortune. Instead of bullying the courtiers of the court from her powerful position as the king's mistress, she tried to win their support. She never revealed the slightest hint of greed or arrogance. She even befriended the queen, the king's wife, the mistress befriended the queen. Absolutely crazy. She simply applied some strategy. She encouraged the king to take young lovers while once she reached a certain age, you know, she was like, you know what, I'm not as young as the king wants me to be. This actually ended up posing less of a threat to her for losing her position, since they could not compare to her charm and sophistication and would soon bore the king, who would then come back to her for some enlightenment. Success plays strange tricks on the mind. It makes you feel invulnerable while also making you more hostile and emotional when people challenge your power. It makes you less able to adapt to circumstances. Very, very fascinating stuff there. Here's a quote from one of my favorite men, Napoleon Bonaparte. The greatest danger occurs at the moment of victory. I mean, this is just straightforward stuff. You know, you cannot go too far. You cannot go too far. You have to know when to stop. And I think this can also be applied at a more ground-based level to gambling. You know, there's always a point where you will win, you will win, you will win, and you have to know when to stop. The best gamblers know when to stop, okay? If you listen, it's funny to say like, oh, you're always like one more away from the big win, but no, the best gamblers always know when to stop. And you can even think about, you know, when you're on a luck of a heat streak for a game, you know, you have to know when to stop. You have to know when, okay, this next game might be the one where I finally lose it. Just got to be careful with all that. Here's the image for you. Icarus falling from the sky. His father fashions his wings of wax that allow the two men to fly out of the labyrinth and escape the Minotaur. Elated by the triumphant escape and the feeling of flight, Icarus soars higher and higher until the sun melts the wings and he hurtles to his death. We've all heard that story of ancient Greek mythology. Here's a good quote from Niccolò Machiavelli, of course, one of the greatest philosophers of his time. Princes and republics should content themselves with victory, for when they aim at more, they generally lose. The use of insulting language toward an enemy arises from the insolence of victory or from the false hope of victory, which latter misleads men often as the action says in their words. For when this false hope takes possession of the mind, it makes men go beyond the mark and causes them to sacrifice a certain good for an uncertain better. People sacrifice a certified good for an uncertain better. As Machiavelli says, you know, either destroy a man or leave him alone entirely. Inflicting half punishment or mild injury will only create an enemy whose bitterness will grow with time and who will take revenge. So in that case, you know, don't, you should know when to fully crush someone, when to fully stop, and when to kind of do half and half. And all just applies to the situation, but Law 47 was certainly a fun one. And that brings us to the final law of the 48 Laws of Power, Law 48, just as important as Law 1. And that is assume formlessness. That's right. Assume formlessness. What does that mean? By taking a shape, by having a visible plan, you open yourself to attack. Instead of taking a form for your enemy to grasp, keep yourself adaptable and on the move. Accept the fact that nothing is certain and no law is fixed. The best way to protect yourself is to be as fluid and formless as water. Never bet on stability or lasting order. Everything changes. Times change, peoples change. Everything changes. The transgression of the law was absolutely beautiful. It talked about Sparta, of course, the ancient warlike city, and how they basically, their solution to other areas in the Italian peninsula, even Africa, Sicily, the Mediterranean, other areas of other like rising groups of people and tribes, is that the Spartan solution was to create a society dedicated to the art of war. Spartans would be tougher, stronger, and fiercer than their neighbors. And this was the only way they could ensure their stability and survival. Nonetheless, it ended up working for a while. They were able to conquer the Persians somehow, despite being totally outmanned. Even Athens, who was much far superior in the words of water and stuff. But after the Spartans conquered Athens, they soon realized, you know, Athens had gotten huge. Athens had gotten huge, and all the money from Athens and their Athenian investors started pouring into Sparta, but the Spartans were trained in warfare, not politics or economics. They were just unaccustomed to wealth in general. You know, that's just not what they had been taught. A Spartan was either in the war or he worked in agriculture. There was no in between. And unfortunately, for the Spartans, this would actually lead to their demise as they were confused by the change in status quo. Sparta grew weaker and weaker due not to their abilities in war, but their inability to adapt to the political systems. Some 30 years after defeating Athens, it lost an important battle with the city-state of Thebes, who it was weaker than Sparta, and almost overnight, this once mighty nation collapsed, never to recover. In the evolution of species, protective armor has almost always been a disaster. I mean, think of the turtle. Think of the turtle. You know, as much as it's protected from its shell, it is slow, it is one-dimensional, easy to be caught by predators. And that's what happens when you don't adapt. Spartans, they were good at war. But when it came down to political thinking, to running a country through the use of money, through the use of political places, they didn't know what to do. And it weakened them somehow, despite how strong they were on the battlefield. The observance of the law, though, here was a fun one. When World War II ended and the Japanese, who had invaded China in 1937 and finally been thrown out, the Chinese nationalists, led by Chiang Kai-shek, decided the time had come to annihilate the Chinese communists, their hated rivals, once and for all. So what did they do? Well, they did not really go about it in one specific way. They ascribed this to two things to taking over, okay? Cowardice in the face of superior forces and inexperience in strategy, okay? They made Mao Zedong, who was the communist leader, he was a poet, a philosopher, more than a general. They knew his tactics. So they let him think that they weren't exactly, They weren't patterned. They were making them seem like they were inefficient. But in reality, what they were doing is they were separating Tizong's forces over and over and over. And if Chiang ever sent an army from one city to reinforce the other, the communists would encircle the rescuing army. Chiang's forces were slowly broken into smaller and smaller units, isolating them from one another, bam to bam to bam. And due to this, they actually ended up falling apart, fading away, and the communists actually won. They actually won because the nationalists, they were just cowardice in the face of fear forces, and they are inexperienced in strategy. And Mao Zedong was able to use this against them by assuming a formlessness, not a specific plan, but by dividing up the forces, he was able to slowly pick them off one by one, till eventually communists controlled all of China. Still do to this day. My goodness. This actually can all be attributed to the board game Go, which is called Wei Qi in China, which is what Mao Zedong played all the time. And it's kind of like chess, much more in-depth, a bigger board, much more pieces, much more moves. And it was just a game that Mao Zedong played. It was really used by generals to really kind of, or just military strategists, to kind of work out ways how to do things. I mean, Mao Zedong was an addict, and his precepts were ingrained in his strategies in real life. A key Wei Qing concept, for example, is to use the size of the board to your advantage, spreading out in every direction so that your opponent cannot fathom your movements in a simple linear way, better known as being formless. Here's a quote from Mao Zedong, actually. When you want to fight us, we don't let you, and you can't find us. But when we want to fight you, we make sure that you can't get away, and we hit you squarely, and wipe you out. The enemy advances, we retreat. The enemy camps, we harass. The enemy tires, we attack. The enemy retreats, we pursue. Always the opposite. Always assuming formlessness. Always keeping them on their guard. That's right. Law 48. Here's the image for you. Mercury, the winged messenger, god of commerce, patron saint of thieves, gamblers, and all those who deceive through swiftness. The day Mercury is born, he invented the lyre. By that evening, he had stolen the cattle of Apollo. He would scour the world, assuming whatever form you desired. Like the liquid metal named after him, he embodies the elusive, the ungraspable, the power of formlessness. And of course, those like the ancient mythology of Greece. Authority here from Sun Tzu of the 4th century. Therefore, the consummation of forming an army is to arrive at formlessness. Victory in war is not repetitious, but adapts its form endlessly. A military force has no constant formation. Water has no constant shape. The ability to gain victory by changing and adapting according to the opponent is called genius. Mm-hmm. That's right. And this can be applied to the real world, as you just have to think. You have to adapt. You have to be formless. You can't accept what society gives you. You can't accept what you are told to be. You have to go out and form that for yourself. That's very important. And I think this is certainly true in some communities, especially in the United States, where certainly for poor people, they certainly feel like they have to fit this mold. Little kids, they're like, okay, I guess my parents are poor, I have to be poor. But there's a select few. I mean, you look at the NBA, there's a lot of sports players all around the world. They started off very poor. Charles Oliveira, for our UFC fans, for example, born in the favelas, was kind of not really destined for anything, just working odd jobs around there, was able to assume formlessness, not take the mold society gave him, and was able to conquer, become a UFC heavyweight champion. It can be applied to many things in this world. Assume formlessness. And ladies and gentlemen, that brings an end to our 48 Laws of Power. That's not the last time I'll touch that book, though. No. Not at all. I'm absolutely excited to use that book the rest of my life. Use the laws that I've learned in this to be aware of power, to obtain power. And honestly, Robert Greene has written so many other books. He's written books on seduction, on human nature, the arts of war. I mean, he's written a lot of books that I feel very intrigued to read soon, but 48 Laws of Power. That'll do it for now, you know, my first read-through of it. It was fun. It was a good time. And it was nice to kind of bring these laws to you guys. I encourage you all to read this book. It certainly is something I feel everyone should be aware of and just something that people need to just keep on their mind when they're going about business with people who they may think are more powerful than them. That'll do it, 48 Laws of Power. Good times, my friend. Good times. With that, that brings one more topic for today's episode. That's right, we're not overdoing it. We're being very simple with this episode as we're going to be recapping UFC Vegas 88. And yeah, wasn't the prettiest card. Not so ever. I didn't even do good on picks, guys. I went 5 and 7, which does bring our total up to 69 and 37 on the year. So it's not too bad. 69 correct, 37 incorrect. But, yeah, just a lot of things I did not expect to happen. And this was just not a good card. This is like a 3 out of 10 card overall. Definitely going to leave it in the past. Definitely done with it. But, yeah, let's get into these fights. Alrighty, kicking off the card, I mean, we had Chad Ann Hellinger and Charlampis Grigiao, and I'll be the first to admit it that I was sleeping on Chad Ann Hellinger a bit. You know, I thought because of the age, 37 years old, he might not be as good, but you know what? He was able to handle Charlampis in his debut, and he was able to get the win by unanimous decision. Scorecards 30-27, 29-28, 29-28. He snaps Charlampis's 4-fight win streak. Wow. But totals for the fight, 85 significant strikes for Chad, 21 for Charlampis. 144 total strikes for Chad, only 26 for Charlampis, as Charlampis goes 4-5 on takedowns for 5 minutes and 24 seconds control time. Chad goes 0-2 for a minute and a half control time. Round 1 gets kicked off. I mean, Charlampis lands one takedown. Chad kind of gets more total strikes in. Very competitive. Round 2, though, I mean, tail the tape. I mean, let me just tell you, Chad and Hellinger, 26 significant strikes to 4. Charlampis gets 3 of 4 takedowns, so I think that might have been the round Charlampis got done. But when it came to round 3, Charlampis just got beat up on the feet. 51 significant strikes to 8. Good win for Chad and Hellinger. He'll now improve to 2-2 in the UFC. Don't really know what's next for Chad or Charlampis. You know, I mean, this is just Charlampis' debut. You know, kid still. And 31 isn't young, but I mean, in the UFC realm, that's not too bad. Bantamweight, though, is kind of approaching that old age. I don't really think either man has a title run left in them, but there's tons of unranked bantamweights who they could potentially challenge in the future. None so much on this card, but we'll see maybe some other guys down the line. Who knows? Charlampis maybe could drop down in weight or something. Who knows? But yeah, I got that pick wrong, but is what it is, but we got the next pick correct. As Thiago Moises took on Mitch Ramirez, and I'll be damned, Thiago Moises got his, what is it now, his 4th career knockout, a TKO, if you will, from a leg kick as he TKOs Mitch Ramirez with a leg kick 15 seconds into round number 3. That was the tale of this fight. Thiago Moises using the leg kicks to just hack away at Mitch Ramirez. 48% of his leg kicks landed. Absolutely incredible. Round 1, you know, Thiago, it was pretty you know, typical Thiago Moises. Round 1, lands a takedown, 4 minutes, 18 seconds of control time, hunting for a submission. But round 2, you know, Thiago started letting the leg kicks go a bit, outstruck him 22-11, did land another takedown of his own, and then round 3, it only took about, I don't know, 2 or 3 kicks, and Mitch went down, and that was that excellent win for Thiago Moises. Good win for him. Good win for him, and that'll be his third win of his last 4 fights. Not too bad. And when we look at his resume, I mean, I'm talking going back to 2020. All right, we'll look at 2020. So in the past 4 years, he has wins over Michael Johnson, Bobby Green, Alexander Hernandez. His losses are to Islam Makhachev, Joel Alvarez, and Benoit Saint-Denis. All right, so Thiago Moises, very talented. Everything was going for him in this fight. And by the way, Mitch Ramirez did take this fight on just about a week's notice. So unfortunately, you know, he did lose on Dana White's Contender Series, did lose his UFC debut, but I think the UFC might bring him back. You know, he's gotten 2 tough competitors to get going, but Tiago Moises. Excellent win. And as we look at the lightweight rankings, I mean, I don't really know if I can give him a ranked opponent right now, but someone like Matt Frivola really comes to mind. Maybe the loser, Bobby Green and Jim Miller, Drew Dober, even someone fun like that. I really think Tiago Moises is talented. His ground game was on point here, and it was just kind of rare to see him leaning on the leg kicks, leaning on the punches a bit. Good win for Tiago. Happy for you. And we predicted him to win. Not the right method, but nonetheless, got it done. And by the way, next pick, correct again. We predicted Jacqueline Morin by round two submission. She decided to get it done in round number one. Jacqueline Morin submits Corey McKenna in round number one. No surprise here. Corey McKenna took her down, wound up in her guard, and Jacqueline Morin threw up a numerous amount. She threw up like four submission attempts from guard. She was trying to get omoplata in, trying to get an armbar, trying to get a triangle. And it was a super awkward moment where Mike Beltran like went to pull her off. Like he went stop. He said stop once. He goes stop. Then he goes wait, back at it. Like he was gonna stop the fight. And then like Jacqueline Morin lost position on the triangle choke. And so then she just went into an arm bar and just about damn near snapped Corey McKenna's arm off. And I was like, good work. Good work, you nun. But Mike Beltran, a good referee nonetheless. I was actually thinking about applying to become an MMA referee. It'd be a fun little side hustle. I know a couple of my buddies, they do a basketball, hockey. A majority of them do hockey. It'd be cool to become an MMA ref. That'd be something fun. But Jacqueline Morin getting her sixth career submission, her eighth career finish of her eight wins. Giving her 100% finish rate. How about that? Are you kidding me? Only loss was their debut last year to Sam Hughes. Since then, a little two-fight win streak, two finishes in the UFC. Not too shabby. Happy for you, Jacqueline. Sky's the limit at women's strawweight. I mean, truly, you can make a run up these rankings. Probably got two or three more fights before you can talk about a ranked contender, but this is a good win to start. As for Corey McKenna, you know, not too bad. 3-2 in the UFC. This does snap a two-fight win streak for her, but like I said, she's one-dimensional, just goes for the grappling, and Jacqueline Morin was easily able to calculate that. So you start off the night 2-1 on predictions, and then, you know, it didn't necessarily go pretty from here. As my 50-50 fight, I did say, by the way, Jacqueline Morin got a 50K performance bonus. I did say this would be closest to fight of the night, and I could think everyone can agree this probably was the fight of the night unofficially. There was no fight of the night reward tonight. But Danny El Puma Silva in his UFC debut beats Josh Koulibaly by a split decision. A competitive fight down the distance. I had Josh Koulibaly, but nonetheless, I said this would be competitive, and Danny Silva really showed his expertise tonight. Now, I'm not going to call this a robbery. But it was just a competitive fight, and it went to Danny Silva. So totals from the fight, 87 significant strikes to 45 in favor of Josh Koulibaly, 89 total strikes to 56. Josh goes 0-for-4 on takedowns. Danny Silva goes 4-of-9 for 5.5 minutes of control time. And round one, I think Josh took round one. Outstruck him 32-11. This is where we really started to see some great striking from Josh. But Danny Silva, able to counter a bit, was landing big shots. Did go 1-of-2 on takedowns, 1.5 minutes of control time. So I gave Josh Koulibaly round one. Now round two, I honestly thought that Josh did enough here. He did get taken down twice for 2 minutes of control time, but he outstruck him 27-11 significantly, landing at 49% land rate. I thought he was doing enough, but those takedowns clearly weighed some more for Danny Silva. Round three comes around, striking's much more close, 28-23 significantly in favor of Josh Koulibaly, 31-29 total strikes in favor of Danny Silva. Danny also goes 1-of-3 on takedowns for 2 minutes of control time. So Danny Silva, good win for the kid. I'll give it to him. This doesn't even make me that mad. Now on a little three-fight win streak. Wins your UFC debut, 9-1 now professionally. And being a guy like Josh Koulibaly, who took Leron Murphy to a decision, whose other losses are to Jalen Turner and a draw against Charles Jourdain, this really shows how good Danny Silva is. I already saw one of my favorite MMA pages, MMA Theory, doing a road to gold, like road to a title shot for Danny Silva. So I'm talking a lot of hype behind this kid. And he's nice and young, 27 years old, but so is Josh, 29. Both these guys will be back, but tonight belongs to Danny Silva. Competitive fight, fun fight. Of all the fights on this card, that's probably one of the more rewatchable ones. Moving on to our next one. I told you how this would go for folks. Our flyweight matchup, Rafael Filho, Ode Osborne. If Ode didn't catch him right away, it was going to be a Rafael Filho submission, and that's exactly what happened. Ode got just about one strike off for Rafael, took him down. Of the 4.5 minutes this fight went down, 3.5, Rafael controlled him. 21 significant strikes to 0, 43 total strikes to 1. 2 submission attempts, finally gets him with the rear naked choke with just over 30 seconds left in round 1. Rafael Filho is legit. Now, as for Ode Osborne, we now know his weakness. All right, we now know his weakness is grappling. And might I add, 1 in 3, his last 4 fights, those 3 losses were by finish. Best Rafael Filho, how about this? 2-1 now in the UFC. All of his fights have been finishes. And his only loss is to Muhammad Mokaev in a competitive fight. Rafael Filho gets his 10th career submission. Absolutely incredible. I'm happy for the 30-year-old. And I'm excited to see him potentially make a little move up these rankings. Honestly, like, I honestly don't really know who he could fight right now. I mean, David Dork, Sumudarji, Tigur Limbekov, Matt Schnell. Matt Schnell could be a fun fight. Rafael Filho and Matt Schnell, if Matt Schnell wants to take on a grappler after just getting knocked out by Steve Ersig. But this was a fun one. Unfortunately, you know, I didn't pick it correctly, but it was weird. I was kind of like rooting for Rafael Filho, so I really have to be careful with my picks I make because then I start rooting for the other guys. But I was happy for Rafael Filho. Good for him. As for Ode, yeah, might be on his way out. Keeps losing to some tough competitors. Next up, women's bantamweight, and I'm very disappointed here. I'm very disappointed. Chelsea Chandler beats Josiah Nunes by unanimous decision, 29-28 across the board. And this was just Josiah Nunes' fight to lose. Fight to lose from the get-go. And I mean, totals from the fight, 58-47 significant strikes in favor of Chelsea Chandler. 100 total strikes to 49 in favor of Chelsea Chandler. She goes 2 of 2 on takedowns for 7 minutes of control time. Round 1, you know, back and forth on the feet. The difference was Chelsea Chandler's takedown, which she then got 2.5 minutes of control time offered. Literally was not even hunting for submission, just grappling her. Round 2, Chelsea Chandler goes 1 of 1 early on, 4 minutes, 11 seconds of control time, 46 total strikes to 9. So Jose Nunez down 2 rounds, manages to keep it on the feet in round 3, outstrikes her 25-23 significantly, but that just wasn't enough. Maybe if it was a 5-round fight, maybe if this was a main event for a belt, but Jose Nunez's 9-fight win streak comes to an end as Chelsea Chandler picks up her first win since October of 2022. Much needed win for Chelsea Chandler. As we look at the women's bantamweight rankings, Chelsea Chandler 14, Jose Nunez 13. They'll probably just flip flop. And I'll be honest, I don't even know who Melissa Mullins is. She's the number 15 ranked women's bantamweight. Never heard of that chick before. But yeah, Chelsea Chandler getting the win here, primed for a fight with anyone looking up the rankings. Jose Nunez, I'd be disappointed with this performance. I very much would. So she hadn't lost since 2013, 11 years later. 11 years unbeaten streak ends on an Apex card. How unfortunate. Chelsea Chandler, though, way to save your little MMA career. Getting into our final prelim of the night, I predicted this right, Mike Davis over Nathan Levi, except, I'll be damned, Mike Davis brought it this fight. This was absolutely crazy. First off, round 1, Mike Davis catches Nathan Levi, drops him. Nathan's able to somehow then reverse it into a takedown, and Mike Davis is then able to get up, reverse that, and gets almost 4 minutes of control time in round number 1. Mike Davis was looking on point. For having a boxing background, I mean, he was doing great on the ground. In round 2, Mike Davis just managed to get into mount, slinking an arm triangle, and that was that. Mike Davis gets his second career submission. Credible for Beast Boy. He's now on a 4-fight win streak, which, honestly, a 4-fight win streak in the men's, what is it, lightweight division? That is not too bad. That is not too bad, Mike Davis. Wins over Mason Jones and Vyacheslav Borshev. Losses are to Sodiq Youssef and Gilbert Burns. I mean, come on, Mike Davis. You're primed for potentially a lightweight shot coming up. But Nate Levi, you know, it's unfortunate. His second career loss. First time he's been finished in his career. Snap a little 2-fight win streak. It's tough for the Israel native. But Mike Davis just had your number tonight. So I was happy with what I saw from Mike Davis. He's able to get it done. Honestly, Thiago Moises, Mike Davis, I feel like that's the fight to make. 2 unranked guys. If Mike Davis can get past Thiago Moises, he should definitely get ranked guy. So I think that's a fight we can make right there. And I'd even do Nathan Levi and Mitch Ramirez. It's so easy to match some of these guys up when you see them on the same card. I think that's what we should do. Fun stuff from Mike Davis. Then we got into the main card. And ladies and gentlemen, if you were to follow me on the first fight of the night, Gerald Meerschaert, round two submission, it hits. I knew it would, and it freaking did. We called it, and I was so happy for Gerald Meerschaert as he gets his 28th career submission win over Brian Barberina. And if you were expecting anything other than what I told you to expect, you'd have been wrong. Gerald Meerschaert on the attack, 2-4 on takedowns in round one, 2 minutes and 15 seconds control time. Round two, 1-3 on takedowns, 2 minutes, 48 seconds of control time. Throws up two submission attempts in the second, is able to get the rear naked choke and puts Brian Barberina to sleep. I mean, Brian, he was holding his neck, he was slinching in, and then he just went out. I mean, I couldn't even tell that he was out. I'm so glad that the ref stepped in. Kudos to Herb Dean, but Gerald Meerschaert absolutely needed this win, was on a two-fight losing streak, had been 1-3 in his last four, and gets his first win since August of 2022. Good stuff, Gerald. Good stuff. Now, of course, as happy as I am for Gerald, getting his 28th career submission, his 34th career finish. I mean, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me, Gerald? Impressive. Brian Barberina is now on a 4-fight win streak, has been submitted in 3 of those fights, and he's been taken down a ridiculous amount, 21 times in his last 4 fights. Oof, this is... Thanks. That's not good at all. Brian, you're kind of in that Tai Tuivasa situation. We'll get to in a second. Don't know if they'll bring him back, but Gerald, middleweight, treating you kindly. Sky's the limit. Call for a legendary fight. Let's get Gerald set up against some other legendary middleweight. I mean, Chris Weidman, Bruno Silva are fighting. I think win or lose, if Chris Weidman wants to keep fighting, that would be a fun fight to make. I'd very much like to see him fight Chris Weidman. If we look at the rankings, I mean, a Jack Hermanson fight, that's something I feel like I'd want to see. Other than that, there's not too many other legends that are coming to mind, but Gerald, happy for you, and we predicted it correctly. Then, next fight on the card, you know, as much as I got Josiane Nunez wrong, I was able to predict Macy Chison beating Pan Kianzian in the women's bantamweight division. This will move Macy Chison from the number 10 spot to the number 6 spot in the rankings. Yet, I'll be damned, she gets a round one submission, earns a 50K performance bonus, gets it in under 4 minutes. I mean, this was shocking. Macy Chison, 3rd career submission, 5th career finish. Wow. Just wow. And by the way, I mean, Pan Kianzian landed a takedown, then Macy Chison landed a takedown, then she landed another takedown. And unlike past fights where she would just look for some control time, she was hunting for the submission. Was able to get a reversal, gets on the back, slitches it in, and Pan Kianzian was forced to tap. Macy Chison, excellent. First fight since September of 2022, first win since May of 2022, and now her only UFC losses in the past 3 years are to Hakuel Penting, your current champion, and Irene Aldana, past title challenger from last summer. Impressive stuff. Pan Kianzian drops her 2nd fight, drops her 3rd in their last 4. So not looking too pretty. So I think we found Chelsea Chandler's next opponent in Pan Kianzian. As for Macy Chison, though, I mean, she was ranked 10, just beat the number 6 girl, going to move up to 6. I'm looking at fights with number 3 Ketlin Vieira, number 2 Myra Bueno Silva. I mean, fun stuff for Macy Chison. If you're getting finishes in the UFC, you will get noticed, and by gosh darn it, she did. Happy for you, Macy. We predicted it, but little did I know this would be my final prediction for the event as we go 0-3 in the final 4 fights. We'll get to why it's 0-3 in the final 4 in a second, but I mean, a pretty like interesting end to the night. I'll say that without a doubt, because we kick things off with our 3rd fight of the main card with an absolute robbery. And might I add, Christian Rodriguez cannot keep getting away with this as he wins his 4th straight fight over his 4th straight undefeated competitor he was fighting as he beats Isaac Dalgarian by split decision. Let me get into this fight because this was a robbery. You know, as close of a fight as this was, I don't understand. First off, round one, no idea how Isaac didn't get the finish here. 3-3 on takedowns, 4 minutes, 48 seconds of control time, 2 submission attempts, 36 total strikes to 5, absolutely dominated him. 81% significant strike land rate, controlled, I don't even know what is, he didn't control all but the 12 seconds it took him to land his first takedown. So that is an insane percentage control time for the first round. Just utterly ridiculous. Nearly finished the fight. Clearly a 10-8 in round number one. Clearly a 10-8. Okay. By the way, every judge had it 10-8. We get into round two. Christian does outstrike him 12-8 significantly, 18-15 total strikes. But Isaac Dalgarian lands 4 of 6 takedowns for 4 minutes and 11 seconds. I feel like everyone watching this was going, okay, Christian Rodriguez is going to need a finish heading into round three. But little did we know, two of the judges gave Christian the round 10-9. It made absolutely no sense watching it live. Christian literally just like, I don't even know how he landed four more strikes or how that weighed it more, but Isaac was just in control all but 48 seconds of this fight. I mean, I was absolutely baffled. Now, round three is what did Isaac in. Completely gassed out. Christian ended up getting 3 minutes and 14 seconds control time as Isaac goes 0 for 7 on takedowns. Christian has more significant strikes, 35 to 5, 74 to 5 total strikes. And he 10-8 Isaac in round number three. So it was a 10-8 round three, 10-8 round one. It all came down to round two. And I'm just saying personally, I did not score for Christian Rodriguez at all. And by the way, Sal D'Amato, the controversial UFC judge, MMA judge in general, scored round two for Christian Rodriguez, which is just absolutely ridiculous. And as I mentioned earlier, he can't keep getting away with this. Christian Rodriguez has now beaten undefeated Isaac Dalgarian, undefeated Cameron Sayman, undefeated Raul Russell Jr., and undefeated Josh Weems. I mean, he is just cannot keep getting away with this. And, you know, in all of those fights, he's almost lost. I mean, absolutely crazy. Christian Rodriguez is actually clearly a legit contender. His only career loss is against Jonathan Pierce up in weight. So, Christian, good win for you, but I don't know how Isaac Dalgarian lost this. Isaac Dalgarian, your stock's going up for me. Dude is clearly legit. Just needs to work on that gas tank heading into round number three. But yeah, I just an absolute robbery. I don't know what to do with you, Christian. I don't know what to do with you. You're on a 4-fight win streak. You've ended four guys' undefeated streaks. Most of this one was more impressive than Ronda Rousey and Cameron Sayman wins. So I don't know. I don't really want to give him, he's not a 4-fight win streak. I don't really want to give him a ranked opponent. I just don't feel like he's worthy of a ranked opponent. But you know what? Maybe, is there any other featherweights on this card on the prelims? You know, Josh Cuiabao, Danny Silva, those are two guys you need to beat to really prove yourself. I think a Josh Cuiabao fight would really show if he deserves a ranked opponent. So best of luck to Christian Rodriguez. As for Isaac Dalgarian, man, you got robbed. Third fight on the card, I cannot believe this. First off, this fight was a split decision, and I honestly don't think should have been. Nonetheless, Ovince St. Preux beats Kennedy Nchukwe by Kennedy Zinchukani, or however you want to say is the African Savage, that's his nickname, by a split decision. And this was just absolutely embarrassing for Kennedy Nchukwe. He just lost to 41-year-old Ovince St. Preux in a fight where I thought he should have knocked him out cold. It was utterly ridiculous. Tolls from the fight, Ovince St. Preux knocked him down in round number three. Significant strikes, 143 to 106. Same for total. Neither man can land a takedown, but round one, Ovince outstruck him by 4. Round two, Ovince outstruck him by 5. Round three, Ovince outstrikes him by 18 strikes and drops him. Impressive performance. Junichiro Kamija or Derek Cleary scored the two rounds to one in favor of Kenny and Chukani, but didn't even matter. Ovince St. Preux gets his first win since May of 2022. The legend, just an absolute legend of the fight game. Congrats to him. Impressive. But Kane Chukani now drops his second straight fight after previously having been on a 3-fight win streak. Very embarrassing for him, but Ovince St. Preux moving up the ranks for most light heavyweight wins. Very impressive. Happy for him. Happy for him nonetheless. Just did not expect that. Did not expect that whatsoever. Kennedy, you're going to be fighting some unranked light heavyweight. You're getting punished for this one. You were fighting down low. You might even get cut for this one. Ovince, I honestly think he should retire. He finally got a win. He's either getting knocked out or he's getting wins. All right, it's just the way it is. But you know what? Good win. I have nothing to say. I have nothing more to say. I could ramble on about this fight. But 40-year-old Ovince St. Preux just beat Kennedy and Chukani, who should be in his prime. Embarrassing to say. Good win, though, for OSP. Co-main event, this card was already looking kind of rough. I mean, don't get me wrong. The Gerald Meerschaert and Macy Chison submissions were amazing. Even the Mike Davis submission. But Christian Rodriguez's decision just didn't go well. Ovince St. Preux and Kennedy Chukani was just so boring. You're almost like, Kennedy should knock him out. And he even had a moment in round three where he could have knocked him out. Instead, he gets dropped. So a rough fight overall. And we get to the co-main event. And Brian Battle takes on Angelusa. And Angelusa just straight up quits in round number two. From an eye injury. The eye injury didn't look that bad, and I'm not one to judge, but even Michael Bisping, who only has one eye, might I add, you, Michael Bisping only has one eye, was talking to Brian Battle in the middle of the octagon, basically like agreed it was a bad stoppage. Or not even a stoppage, just like bad no contest. And the camera panned to him. And you just see Bisping's face turn. And he just looks like startled that the camera's on him. So he goes back to acting all professional. It was pretty comical. But round one, Brian Battle handling business. 23 significant strikes to 17. 24 total strikes to 20. 1 of 2 on takedowns for a minute and a half control time. Clearly took round one. And I mean, round two, Angelusa had 2 more total strikes than him. But I mean, Brian Battle was handling this fight. The butcher Brian Battle was looking on point. And unfortunately, fight is called a no contest. And these two were jawing at each other as it was being ruled a no contest. So I was almost like, okay, Angelusa, why are you going at him? You just said you couldn't fight. You were just embarrassing yourself. I don't know what to make of this. Brian Battle's stock really went up with this. I even saw on Twitter, people were saying like, yeah, definitely Brian Battle should have been given the win here. But just like a fight we're going to see next weekend between Kurt Hollibaugh and Trey Ogden. Trey Ogden ran into a similar situation where he was winning a fight. It was stopped was ruled a no contest. I think Brian Battle is going to get rewarded with an easy opponent next time out to get another win. And honestly, we could run this fight back since there's a little bad blood here. But yeah, unfortunate for both guys. They're both on 2-fight win streaks. So next time they fight, hopefully they can make it a 4-fight unbeaten streak. But yeah, this just left a sour taste in the mouth on already just dull Apex card. Getting into our main event, it just couldn't have ended worse. And you know, even though I picked Tai Tuivasa, the whole MMA community was just rooting for Tai Tuivasa. This felt like finally a chance for him to get back in the win column as he took on the number 10 ranked Marcin Tybura. And instead, you know, what happens? He gets submitted in round number 1 against Marcin Tybura as Marcin Tybura gets his 8th career submission. How about that? Marcin Tybura also getting his first win since February of last year as Tai Tuivasa drops his 4th straight fight. All of those he's lost by finish. And the fight lasted 4 minutes. And let me just say, it started off and Tai Tuivasa was on fire. I mean, he was clipping Marcin Tybura. Tybura's head started bleeding. And then he just started getting pressured up against the cage, got taken down. Tybura found his way to his back, was able to get a rear naked chokehold in. And that was that. That was that. Tai Tuivasa goes to sleep. It was very baffling. I was almost just like, damn, that really just happened. But first off, good win for Marcin Tybura, 38 years old, needed this win. He'll remain in the top 10 nonetheless. He'll be ranked number 9, which is very impressive. And will there be any more easy fights for him? No. I mean, Jarzinho Rozenstruik called him out. He was already like, no, I don't want to fight Jarzinho Rozenstruik. But I do think that could be a fun fight. Derek Lewis rematch, Jarzinho Rozenstruik fight. And you know, honestly, he could fight up against someone like Halton Almeida. Sergey Spivak, you know, someone like that who needs a win. Sergey Pavlovich, my goodness, give him a pick-me-up fight. But as for Tai Tuivasa, he'll now be ranked, gosh, probably 11th. It's just not looking good for Tai. It's not looking good for him. This was a terrible look. Gosh, and it's been rough going for Tai. I mean, hasn't won since February of 2022. He's been knocked out in September 2022. Knocked out in under a minute in December 2022 again. Submitted badly by Alexander Volkov back in September. And this finish was almost worse than the others because this was just a fight he shouldn't have lost. He did look out of shape. I was told that he was battling an injury heading into this camp or he got surgery or something. But nonetheless, tough loss for him. Nothing much more to do if they want to give him a Rodrigo Nascimento, Shamil Gaziev, Marcos Rogério de Lima, a pick-me fight up of some kind. That'd be more than kind, but by looks of it, might be on his way out. We'll see, though. We shall see. Marcin Tybura getting his 16th career finish of his 25 career wins. Not too bad. Not too bad, Marcin. And by the way, Marcin Tybura, of his last 5 fights, 3-2, losses are to Tom Aspinall and Alexander Volkov. That's not too bad. In fact, those are his only losses since 2019. Marcin Tybura, always been a threat in this division. But yes, performance bonuses to Marcin Tybura, Macy Chisone, Rafael Filho, and Jacko Morum for their submissions. We actually had 6 submissions of the 13 fights on this card. Huh. I wonder if that's close to a record or anything. I don't know. Now, cap it off, folks. UFC Vegas 88 will leave in the past, and unfortunately, we have to look forward to UFC Vegas 89, which is statistically on paper worse, but I don't think it could actually get worse. We head to the women's flyweight division for our spotlight fight as Amanda Ribas takes on Rose Namajunas in our main event. No one asked for this, no one wanted this, but nonetheless, we're going to get it. In the co-main event, Justin Taffa steps in to fight Carl Williams, who's supposed to take on his brother. Fascinating enough, Edmund Shahbazyan will take on AJ Dobson, and a loser leaves, most likely. Young Guns Peyton Talbot and Cameron Sayman will square off in unranked bantamweight action. Featherweight Billy Quarantillo back in action. He gets a fun one against Yusuf Zalal. We also get Trey Ogden on the prelims, Ricardo Ramos, Cody Gibson, Stephen Wynn, Muhammad Usman. A lot of notable names, but yeah, just nothing too exciting, unfortunately. I'll tell you what, I'm looking forward to UFC Atlantic City going down March 30th. Aaron Blanchfield, man, if you're not pumped for that fight. Chris Weidman, Bruno Silva, yeah, you're probably going to see a Bruno Silva knockout. Alonzo Menfield, Carl Zuberg, that's going to be a banger. The debut of Ibo Aslan in the UFC. The return of Chidi and Chukani, going to be fun. You get Vicente Luque, Joaquin Buckley, Nursultan Ruzabov is back, Andre Petroski's back, yeah. That one's going to be fun in front of a live crowd. And it all builds up to UFC 300. Pumped for that one. We'll see what comes of all of that. And by the way, the UFC 301 main event isn't even official yet. I think they're waiting to see if Alex Pereira gets a quick knockout, because then they might rebook him quickly against Magomed Ankalaev. But ladies and gentlemen, that'll draw an end to episode 75 of the Surprise Jab Podcast. I was looking to make this under an hour, but nonetheless, there's just so much to talk about with these UFC events. I don't really like time myself for them. I like to just kind of give myself free reins to talk. So that'll conclude everything. We may be dropping a surprise episode. You know, I kind of record these in bits and pieces throughout my night. So I may be recording a surprise episode, making my March Madness bracket, maybe going over the first 10 WrestleManias, any new news that happens in the days, but we say bon voyage to UFC Vegas 88. We say goodbye to episode 75. We definitely say goodbye to whatever this UFC event we just watched. I mean, 48 Laws of Power, we're saying goodbye to that. But what makes me so happy is that I get to tell all of you, have a good day. I don't know, I had nothing big to say. Wanted out there. Ladies and gentlemen, I will catch you next time on the Surprise Jab Podcast.